Okay, everybody, I'm here. This is Ernest Priestley. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Good, you?
Good, okay. I'm going to mute the callers here, and we're going to get started here shortly. Hold on. Okay, everybody. Well, this is our, I believe it's going to be our seventh conference call that we've had so far, and we're very fortunate to have again Chantal, who was with us the first time for the Autism 101, and she's actually back. She's actually going to replace the call that we had today. That individual was unfortunately sick, so she was unable to participate. So one of the things we wanted to do is kind of introduce her here, and I have a kind of a pre-written script here that I wrote. Chantal is actually an international speaker, author, and advocate who's been involved with autism spectrum disorders for over 20 years as both a parent and a professional on both sides of the Atlantic. Chantal also currently hosts radio shows in English and French for Autism One Radio. And she also writes for various publications, including the Ask Chantal column for the Autism File, and also she blogs occasionally as well. Now, one of the things that's unique about Chantal is she is a mom to a son who has autism, and she has written extensively about this subject, and so she really brings with us not only just the knowledge behind it, but also just the on-hands work that she's had to deal with this over the years as she's raised her son. So it's a great perspective. So Chantal, welcome again.
Thank you for having me, and I noticed that you didn't pronounce my last name because you were afraid.
Yes, I was very afraid.
I wish my last name was Smith, but it's not. It's Cecile Kira. So my name is Chantal Cecile Kira, and I've written 3 books. So I'm not an occupational therapist, but I do have a lot of experience with occupational therapy because of my son's needs. He's very impacted by autism, and a lot of it has to do with sensory processing. So he's received all kinds of therapies in that area since he's little, and also I have done quite a bit of research for the 3 books that I've written. The first one was Autism Spectrum Disorders, the second one was Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum, and the third one, which just came out, is Autism Life Skills. So when I'm going to be talking about occupational therapy and sensory integration right now and answering questions, I'm doing it from research that I've done for those books, as well as experiences from my son, but also as an advocate, I've helped a lot of people in IEP meetings or, you know, to get services for these kinds of therapies for their children based on their children's needs. And also, I have to say, another new aspect I have is for my 3rd book, Autism Life Skills, I interview people on the spectrum, and I ask them what was important for them growing up. And that is why I wrote that book, because my son is now 17, or actually was 17 when I started writing the book. He's 19 now, and I wondered what was important to people on the spectrum growing up.
Sure.
And the reason why I bring this up is because the number one factor that all of them said impacted their lives, and it didn't matter whether they were very impacted by autism like my son and could respond to interviews just by typing, or if they had Asperger's, all of them suffered from sensory integration processing difficulties. And this really colored their world and colored growing up. I was really blown away by the amount of information that I received from these people about how it affected them, and that people with Asperger's that we think don't have any sensory processing issues or very little actually have some. It's just that because they have Asperger's, they're able to compensate and learn different ways of handling themselves in situations which those that are more impacted with autism, such as my son, may not be able to do so. And so this is really very insightful because it explains a lot of the behaviors and a lot of situations that I didn't know were really as a result of sensory issues.
Sure.
I don't know if you wanted to start asking me some questions, Ernest.
Yes, I can do that. You saw some of the list of questions that we received initially. Is there any on there that you wanted to take right away?
OK. Okay, I'm going to look at the first list.
Yes, the first one. That's fine. We can start with that.
Okay. The first one is someone from Florida asked, my son walks on his tiptoes all the time. We are constantly telling him to walk on flat feet, but he still continues. He also has a very awkward gait. He's a very hard walker and moves his whole bottom half side to side when he walks. What can we do to help with this? Okay, well, actually, toe walking, the theory with toe walking is that it has to do with sensory processing, with the problem area in the vestibular. So I'm going to explain a little bit about what that is. For people who don't know that much about sensory integration challenges, it's or sensory processing disorder is the correct term these days. It's really described as the inability to process information received through the senses. So what this means is that people either have too much information coming in that they can't screen out, or they have little information coming in. They may be mono-channel, which means that if they're listening and they're using their auditory processing, they can't use their visual processing. So most of us are pretty familiar with the fact that we use the senses of vision and auditory and touch and smell and taste. But there are two areas that are really important that are challenges for people on the spectrum. And one of them is called vestibular, and the other is proprioceptive. Now, vestibular has to do with where your body is in space. So this means that where it is in relation to the surface of the earth. So you know there are some people who can't stand the rides at the fairground, and yet there are other kids, like I know my son is always seeking that kind of spinning motion. That has to do with the fact that they don't have their vestibular sensing mechanism working correctly. So the proprioceptive is where your arms are or your limbs are in relation to the trunk of your body. And why this is important is that, for example, somebody who's walking on their tiptoes is having, the theory is, and most likely it is, they're having a problem with their vestibular. Like where they can't keep their feet flat on the ground because they're having problems with figuring out where their body is in space.
Right.
And when we talk about kids on the spectrum who perhaps don't look like they have very many sensory processing issues, but you may notice that someone's awkward or clumsy and he's not very good at sports, I mean, other than the social aspect, and that has to do with the proprioceptive, where they're not sure where they're how to move their arms and legs and where those are in relation to the rest of their body, which makes them clumsy. And so it really affects our everyday life all the time. So if just by telling somebody to walk on their flat feet is not going to be helpful, and the fact that this person has a very awkward gait and moves kind of funny when he walks shows that he probably does have a vestibular challenge. And I would definitely suggest sensory integration with an occupational therapist. And it could be that once they do an assessment, they might say that he needs physical therapy, because there's a difference between physical therapy and occupational therapy. But I would start with an occupational therapist. And the thing that I do want to warn listeners who are not familiar with sensory integration or occupational therapy is you really have to be careful who you see. And I have learned through trial and error. And, you know, people may think that I'm so knowledgeable because I wrote all these books, but I always learn new questions that I should have asked of professionals working with my son. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you want to make sure is, does the occupational therapist have training in sensory integration? This is very important because many school districts hire occupational therapists, and what they do is they just sit down and try and teach your kid handwriting. Okay? That's not someone who's going to help with the sensory integration needs of your child. The other thing is ask, do they have experience with autism? Now, not just autism in general. I once asked that question, and they said yes. Well, it turns out this woman had only experience with Asperger's syndrome, not with someone as impacted by autism as my son. So she was very ineffective with my son, but she might have been great with somebody who had Asperger's. Then another question that comes up is that people should ask is, do you have experience working with this age group? Because sensory integration that you do with younger children will look different than sensory integration you do with older children and teenagers. Do you want to make sure that the professional you have has experience in the areas or at least the age area and ability level of your child? The other thing people should know is that occupational therapy and sensory integration are things that you should be able to have provided by your school district. And if it's okay if I jump ahead here, because I had read some of these questions, I'm going to try and find this question because somebody asked, oh, my son's too old for occupational therapy. What else can I do? And they're saying their child is 12. Now, I would bet $100, and I don't know if the person's listening right now, but I would bet $100 that they say the child's too old because that's what the school district told them. Because I've never known a good occupational therapist to say that it's too old to do occupational therapy with somebody. Of course, everything's better to do when they're young. But think of it this way. People that have strokes or that are in accidents and lose the use of one or two of their limbs, they go to therapy and they learn to reuse their limbs, and they use, by using their arm and their legs in certain motions, it recreates the synapses in the brain. And so it's never too old to learn and to work on the motor aspects of your body. But I'll tell you that when my son went from being in sixth grade, which was one school district, and was transferring over to junior high, into another school district, all of a sudden, he wasn't eligible for OT anymore. It was like he was cured over the summer of OT needs. And this kid who was getting, you know, 2 hours private, well, not private, but one-on-one a week. And all of a sudden, he doesn't need it anymore. But really what they were saying is, we don't provide it anymore. And when we started discussing, because, of course, I had an assessment that showed that he needed it, oh, well, we just don't provide it. Well, you just can't say you don't provide it, you know. There's laws. And so I just want to kind of, because there are a lot of questions here that people say, how can I have this paid for? You need to get it through your school district. And what's really important is to get, if you don't agree with the school's assessment, you find an outside person. You can ask people in your area, whatever support groups that you have, if anybody knows a good OT. And then you interview the OTs and you find someone who will do an assessment of your child that you feel comfortable with. And then that assessment will show whether your child needs therapy or what kind of therapy. And then it's up to the school district to provide. So I just want to be really clear on that because this is something that should be provided by the school district. So don't let them say it can't help your child anymore because it can. So that's
very good.
My little question. Did you have something you wanted to say or ask?
No, actually, I was going to ask you, you know, people do struggle with their school districts a lot in this particular issue. I mean, is there any tips that you can give them you kind of hit on it initially, but are there any other tips that you can give them that might help them sort of break the wall, if you will, for this deal with this issue?
Right. Well, the first thing is you have to base it on your child's needs. So it's not because your neighbor's kid is getting something that you're going to get it. And the school district is allowed to do their own assessments, but you are allowed to ask for an assessment as well. But you have to pay for it. So that's where it becomes difficult because you might need to see if this is an assessment covered by your insurance, or you might be out of pocket for the initial assessment. But in the long run, if it's going to help you get the services for your child, it's worth it. But as I said, you want to make sure you find the right professional, and you only get that by asking other professionals that you trust and other parents who have been in the same situation. So once you have an assessment done, you have an IEP meeting, you know, you can request an IEP meeting, and make sure the professional is there to explain his assessment and to make his recommendation. And then if the school district doesn't agree with that recommendation, then, you know, you have to start. You can talk about either negotiating where you're going to go on that, or else if this is really an important issue for you, you know, there's always filing for due process, but normally it doesn't get to that for OT. You might disagree on the amount of OT they get, But the important thing also for OT is to repeat things. So even if someone is working with your child, you want to make sure that either you or a tutor or someone knows what's going on in those sessions so that you can repeat some of the things and use some of the tips repeatedly. But that's the most important thing, is to have a really good assessment done, because if a professional is saying that your child has a certain need, you should have that provided by your school district.
Right.
So that's my tip on that. And I always tell people in terms of IEPs, it's really hard not to be emotional, but you have to think of it as a business meeting. So what would you do if you're trying to convince your boss or your colleague of something, is to get all these facts and information together and then go to the table and say, you know, this is what I need. You know, how can you help me with this? You know, and you attack it from the point, not attack it, but you discuss it from the point of view of, we're all in this together to help this child.
Exactly.
And so that's the way I would talk about it.
Yeah, a lot of people tend to have, sometimes it tends to be confrontational at times. And,
you get fed up after a while. I can understand that, but I always say, you know, get that out of your system before the IEP meeting, because you're not going to catch flies with vinegar.
Right.
<You know? laughs> Old tip for there.
Definitely.
Okay, so I'm going to continue with a couple of questions here. Someone asks about auditory defensiveness, and does that play a part in a child's inability to process language sounds? In other words,
yours from Plano, Texas, I think.
Yeah. In other words, is the AD impeding his ability to process sounds, or is it just possible that he has both sensory integration disorder and APD? We know for a fact that he has the sensory integration disorder, and we're awaiting audiology testing to determine if he also has the auditory processing disorder. Where are you located? Well, that was for the OT, I guess. Yes, auditory defensiveness and also auditory processing disorder does affect the child's ability to process language. And so this person's doing the right thing by having both the sensory integration assessment and also the audiology testing. Again, with the audiology testing, you would try to find somebody who is familiar with trying to test kids with autism. But all that does impact the ability to process sounds. It's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Someone from Houston says, my son is 22 and does not want to wear any clothing. What can I do? I would say move to Germany. There's many clothing options there. That's a joke, okay? I hope people haven't
seen that. I know.
I heard there was somebody from New York on the line. I know people from New York have a sense of humor, so I guess that he
does
things like that.
Yes, they do. They do.
It might be a little inappropriate, though. But this is a hard problem, not wanting to wear clothes, because I think if he's not wanting to wear clothes, he's having a lot of issues with the feel of the clothing. So the first thing I would do is try and find really soft materials. Like, there's some cottons now that are so soft they feel almost buttery, and see if you can tolerate those kinds of clothing, and nothing tight or restrictive, but very loose. And I would suggest wearing them just starting with a few minutes and then working your way up to longer and longer. But the point is, it has to be very comfortable, or comfortable to him, and otherwise he's not going to wear them. So that's what I would suggest, and maybe that's something the parents already has suggested. If that's the case, I would definitely try and find someone who has experience with the older, with the teenage population or the young adult with sensory integration experience. Okay. Someone, Carrie from Cody. We have a teacher who gives my son a big bear hug just after PE to help calm him down after all the excitement. We have another teacher who will just lean in heavily on his shoulders during work time. He pretends he's just checking on him, but uses the chance to give him a little sensory input. The paraeducators and other teachers are looking for other ways to help him. Do you have ideas? Well, my first thing is, I would like to know how old this boy is, because it may not be appropriate for him to be having a big bear hug from his teacher if he's older and a teen. And we do have to be careful about those kind of things because of the mixed messages that we could be sending our teenagers about appropriate and inappropriate behavior,
sure.
You know, as you get older in terms of touching with adults. But that, I can understand why he's giving them the big hug. Also, talking about leaning heavily on his shoulders, that's a good idea. A thing that works really well for a lot of kids is wearing a backpack, but that has a certain number of books in it. Like, you kind of have to figure out how much weight the child wants to feel that sensory input. And we have found that works really well for quite a few kids, the backpack that's kind of heavy. And so they could wear that. They can wear that backpack most of the time, and that looks really appropriate in a school setting. So
okay.
That's really good for sensory input. And as a kid gets older, you want to try and teach him himself to be giving himself his own, like, squeezes and a little bit of massaging. So, again, not knowing the age of the child, it's hard to suggest that. But some kids can end up teaching themselves how to do that, like to squeeze their legs or squeeze their arms or squeeze their shoulders, and that can help. Of course, I suggest these things, but my son is a type of person that has not been able to learn to squeeze himself, but I know other kids who have. So I know that some of these suggestions can't help everybody. They can help some.
Right.
So the difference, other question from Albany, New York. What is the difference between occupational therapy and sensory integration therapy? Aren't they
That's
one
and
the
question.
Same? It is a very good question. It's not the same thing. Sensory integration therapy is usually done by people who are trained in occupational therapy. But occupational therapy is more about how you use your hands or your body in functional ways for practical things. For example, for working on fine motor, like buttoning your pants or pulling up your zipper or anything that's fine motor that has a practical use to it, like you're strengthening the fingers so they can pry open and close lids of containers that they have for, you know, be able to get food out. For the gross motor skills, it could be anything that has to do that's going to help them function. So if they're having problems with the strength in their arms for lifting things or the strength in their legs for walking. Some of that gross motor stuff also kind of crosses with what the physical therapists do, but the difference is that with OT, the goal is a functional one. So you're not just talking about the strength of the leg or the strength of the arm, but a goal such as, for example, in my mom's case, she's getting occupational therapy because she's now in a wheelchair, and so her goal is to be able to move the wheels of her wheelchair with her arms. So she might be getting some arm strengthening exercises from the physical therapist, but she's also getting it from the occupational therapist. The occupational therapist is working more on how do you use the arms to actually move the wheelchair. So sensory integration, on the other hand, is how do you get all those different senses that I named, auditory, visual, the sense of feel and touch, the smell, the vestibular and the proprioceptive, how do you get that all integrated together so that everyone, so that the person is processing through all those different channels? Now, why is sensory processing so important? It's because that's the way we discover as babies the world and how we figure out what things are. So, you know, when babies start crawling, they're looking for things, and then they put things in their mouth, and they're touching, and they're feeling. This is how they identify the world around them. So if their visual processing isn't working or their auditory isn't working and it's too sensitive, then you have a real problem because they aren't able to make sense of all of that. And when you can't make sense of all of that, then the world kind of loses meaning for you. And that's when some of these kids kind of shut down because it's too much information at once. And the thing that I learned a lot from adults when I was interviewing for my book, Autism Life Skills, is how much this really impacts everything. So, for example, social relationships. We always think of that being a problem because they don't understand the social skills or the social parameters, but a lot of them explain to me that they had problems, and I'm talking about the ones who were very verbal, so high-functioning autism and Asperger's. They claimed to me that, for example, this one gentleman, he had a terrible time meeting new people because of, A, the smell. It was like a new smell he had to deal with. There's a new visual he had to deal with, and he can't process the visual with the hearing, his auditory, at the same time. He's mono-channeled. There's only one channel that works at a time. So if he's meeting a new person and he's focusing on their face, so he's trying to learn their face so he can recognize them again, and then he notices their mouth is moving and their eyes are blinking, he can't hear what they're saying. I mean, he can hear it, but he can't process it. So then he's lost that conversation. So then whatever he responds is out of sync. Okay? So that's one area. The other area is sometimes it's overwhelming to be in social situations because there's too much noise or too much light. And that is very, very tiring and taxing to people on the spectrum. Here's a perfect example of how sensory processing affects people on the spectrum in ways that we, that I didn't fathom at least. I'm sitting in the hotel lobby interviewing a person with Asperger's, and we're sitting together talking, and all of a sudden her cell phone goes off, and she says, just a minute, and she leaves. She comes back 20 minutes later, and I say, you know, everything okay? I thought maybe she got a call from home or something. And she said, oh, yeah, when I'm out in public, I get overwhelmed by the new sounds and the new different lights around me that I forget to use the restroom because I can't feel my body. I cannot feel my body in situations of sensory overload. So I always have to set my cell phone to remind myself to use the restroom. Now, I was blown away because, you know, my son still has toileting issues at 19. And, you know, sometimes I get the feeling professionals think that, you know, I haven't followed through on my behavior plans. You know, I haven't, I'm not doing everything I should. But at the end of the day, now that Jeremy can communicate by typing, he has said to me, I didn't feel it coming, I couldn't feel my body. He will not go in certain stores with very sharp, high-voltage fluorescent lights, and he'll say, too much light. And when he was younger, he used to actually wet his pants as soon as we entered a store that had a lot of fluorescent lighting. And so I've always been made to feel like this sensory issue has to do with being on the less able end of the spectrum, but it doesn't. And so I thought, okay, maybe this is a one-off instance, but I asked other people that I interviewed, okay? And a lot of the other people said they had the same situation. They said, oh, yeah, when I leave my house, I always set my cell phone to remind myself to use the restroom. I can't feel my body in a situation overwhelmed, and I don't know if I'm going to be overwhelmed or not if I'm going to a new place. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. That really is.
So it has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with whether or not you can feel your body. And so this was really helpful for me because now I thought, well, you know, I usually remind myself, or the tutors remind ourselves of when if Jeremy doesn't go, we have to prompt him to go use the restroom every couple of hours. And so now we're getting him a watch that we can set for him that we're going to train him that when he hears that to go use the restroom. And then eventually he can set the watch. But you see how having information for even those on different ends of the spectrum can be very useful.
Definitely.
But I was amazed at things like this. So now I should probably answer some more questions. You see, I can go on and on for hours here, Ernest.
Oh, it's okay. We've gotten we've gotten like 20 more questions since you've been talking. It's really, really vibing off what you've discussed so far. So, can continue on and we can pick up some new ones too.
Here's another one from Renee in Minnesota. Is there any other types of therapy that a teenage boy can do? Have done years of OT, but now too old. Any suggestions, clues, clothes, food, soaps, etc.? Okay, well, first of all, OT is not too late for a teenage boy, but maybe she's saying it's plateauing. And she mentions clothes, food, soaps, and maybe is that because she's having the child is having sensory issues? I don't know what kinds of sensory integration this person's been doing, but I know it doesn't sound like vision therapy is something that would help her, but vision therapy is something also you can do at any age, and that's when you're having children that have a problem processing through their visual sense. Another thing that is useful is auditory integration training. And that's for people who are having problems with their auditory processing. And the reason why having good visual processing and also auditory processing is because this is how we learn, especially at school. And this is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine that we always hear about how children with autism are helped mostly with visual reminders, and that everything should be visual, and that's how most of them are learners, is visual learners. Well, I don't think that's true. I think the ones that we've been successful with are visual learners because most of us are visual learners. So we have adapted the way that we teach them through visual prompts because of also hearing from people like Temple Grandin, who's very well known. She is a visual person. But people like Tito and my son, who are very impacted by autism, visual schedules and things like that have not worked for them, but auditory reminders and auditory schedules have worked, and that's because they're visually not processing, but their auditory processing is working well. So that's another thing you have to be careful about, knowing what which processing sense is working the best, because that's going to be the way they learn.
Right.
Okay, so again, Judy from Farmersville, California said, can a child of any age still benefit from this treatment? My son is almost 12 and still has sensory problems, although the autism has improved. Again, yes, it can help. But what you do have to start thinking about when they're teenagers is, what kinds of ways can you accommodate for this child, because certain things are going to be harder for them, and meanwhile they still have to live in society while they're getting these issues taken care of.
Right.
So it's important to work on the sensory problems, but sometimes we do have to accommodate for them. Okay.
I have an interesting question here,
okay.
If you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Louis Bryant from Corning, Arkansas, and his question is, who is qualified to teach sensory integration? Are schools, the person is not trained. Should they not get training from a specialist before they implement a program for our kids' IEP?
That is a very good question. And yes, there are schools that offer sensory integration programs. But you want to be careful, and I would specify in the IEP that someone shows a work that has been trained in sensory integration, but also shows a working knowledge of sensory integration techniques. Also, if your child depends on the age of your child, you should have that mentioned. So, for example, my son was in junior high, and I had it written in his IEP that the sensory integration had to be done by somebody who had sensory integration training, but also experience with adolescents. And you know what? I put in that stipulation because the person that they gave my son as an occupational therapist with sensory integration training was straight out of school, so yes, she had the training. She didn't have the working experience, and she had not learned how to work with teenagers, and she gave my son rug burns, front and back, because she was using a technique that they do with the little kids where you pull them around on a mat by their arms or their legs, and they love that feel, and it helps them with some of their sensory processing.
That's where you're getting back to. That's what your point before was. It has to be age.
Right.
It has to be age appropriate.
Right, and so that you can't do with a teenager. And the other thing is, when she was pulling him out on a rug, and she hadn't noticed that his T-shirt was pulled up. So he was just getting rug burns everywhere. very, very painful. And the doctor saw that, because he came home and I said, what is this? So I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, my gosh, those are rug burns. But so you want to make sure, and I say the same thing for when it's aides or paraprofessionals, when we're talking about applied behavior analysis or any kind of training, I don't say that they must be trained, because some of these school districts, they give your kid 2 hours of training. I mean, they give your kid's aide 2 hours of training. They say, oh, she's trained. I put in, and I learned this from an attorney, I put in that the paraprofessional must show that they have a working knowledge of. They must demonstrate a working knowledge of. And then of whatever it is, ABA or of sensory integration. But there are schools for sensory integration. You know, there are programs that OTs have to follow, and that's what they should make sure is written in the IEP as well.
Okay. Do you want to pick up another question on your end?
Yes. Sarah from Halstead. I have so much trouble with my son misunderstanding things and overreacting. He's so inflexible in his beliefs of what happened to him that I can't reason with him. Any ideas? Again, I wish I knew how old this child is, because some of this behavior happens when kids hit puberty, regardless of whether they're on the autism spectrum or not. You know, you start getting children that become non-compliant and start overreacting. But this misunderstanding things and overreacting, it could be that he really can't help it, and it could be the sensory overload, again, that's making him overreact. One of the things that I learned from everyone that I interviewed is how much any kind of transition was a very difficult area for them because of the sensory processing. Because once they were used to routine, what happens is if the sensory processing issues are painful for them, it's okay because they get used to it. Like, they know that every day at this time, I'm going to have to go down this crowded hallway that's really crowded and noisy, and I'm going to feel all these people touching me, brushing up against me. But they can handle it for a certain amount of time because they know that it's going to happen. It's like they psych themselves. Like with my son, he knew that he was going to the dentist. So if I told him a week ahead of time, he could prepare himself for the fact that he would be in that situation. At first, he didn't like to go. He never really ended up liking it. But it got to the point where if I forgot to tell him and put an icon up a week ahead of time, if I just told him the day before, he was okay with it. Because over time, he got used to the fact that he could psych himself into putting up with it. But if you have constant change in routines, for kids who don't understand what's happening next, a lot of it has to do with they're afraid of having some sensory overwhelm. So they said that the best thing you can do for any child with autism, if you only did one thing, was to make sure that you worked on their transition. Telling them ahead of time what was going to happen next was something that really helped, and this helped all their behaviors. Because then you didn't have somebody overreacting because they knew what would happen next. So that's an area like this person. It might not be that he's just misunderstanding things. He could be overreacting because he's overwhelmed. And that's why sensory integration is good, because it helps people become aware of what it feels like when they're reaching overload. So, for example, if you have a child who can't tolerate certain noises or certain noisy situations, and you can observe this child, and you know when the tipping point is, but they don't know when the tipping point is, but you watch them, and you take notes on it, and you don't tell them then because they're too upset, but when they've calmed down at another time, that's when you have a little talk about, you know, even if you don't know how much they understand. For example, my son, I didn't know for years if he understood us or not, but I always talked to him as if he understood. You know, but I also showed some visuals, too. But you explain to them what, and you try and ask them, what did it feel like right before, you know, you had that meltdown? Like, to me, it looked like you were feeling this, and, you know, you started hyperventilating, and you started flapping your arms, and I knew that you were going to have that meltdown. So then eventually, they learned to recognize by figuring out what's going on with their body before they get to that tipping point, and then you can teach them to tell people they need a break. Like, my son has a break card, so, because it takes too long to type things out. So always on his desk is, when he's mainstream, sticking out of a binder is a break card and a restroom card. If he needs a break, he just hands the card and walks out the door, and he'll go do a walk around, and that's going to get his, for my son, that's what helps him. Other people like jumping on a trampoline. Other people just need to play with something in their hands. But that's helping them be in control of their behaviors by giving them control over understanding what's going on to their bodies.
Okay.
Is that helpful?
Yes, very helpful. I've got a question here. It's sort of a two-part question, but I guess I just, what is auditory integration training?
Okay.
I have not heard
that one.
I'm sorry?
What's the second part of the question?
Oh, yes. Essentially, the question was this. We considered auditory integration training for my son, but he's only 3 years old. Does this benefit someone this young, or is it best to wait until they're older and can respond better? So it's from Linda from New Jersey.
Okay, that is an excellent question. Because, first of all, I'm going to explain auditory integration training. But, yes, it would help. It helps young kids, but I don't know about the age of 3, because my understanding is they would have to be able to sit, you know, relatively quietly. But I can tell you that I know a very good auditory integration therapist whose name is Terry Silverman. I'm going to try and find her email, because that's a good question for her.
Good.
That maybe if the person's listening, they would be able to contact her by email. They can say that I gave.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I'm just looking up the email now. Because that's the kind of question you do want to ask an occupational therapist. They may say 3 years old is too young, but they may say that it's fine. But let me explain what auditory integration therapy is. It's hard for me to type and talk at the same time. I can't multitask.
Yes, neither can I.
Okay. Her name is Terry Silverman, and here's her email. It's T as in Thomas, E... RRIES at EXECPC.com. So that's TERRIES at EXECPC.com. So what is auditory integration training? Auditory integration training is a method where you try and teach or train the child's auditory processes to focus in on different things. So, for example, someone who gets easily overwhelmed by too much noise, the reason why they do that is because they can't filter out different sounds. So, for example, let's say that we were talking in a cafe, Ernest, and there's a lot of noise around us. You can hear people moving their chairs. You can hear people talking, having their own discussions, people pouring, making the coffee. But because you're not autistic and you don't have sensory integration issues, you can just look at me and focus on my voice. So all the other noises goes in the background. But
it's filtered out.
It's filtered out. But people who have auditory integration difficulties can't filter it out. And it's also as if they were on a tuner for the radio and they couldn't find the right channel. So they're listening to all the stuff in between, but they're not getting the clear sound. So when you go for auditory integration training, they have a special machine, and you usually do it twice a day for a 10-day or a 2-week period, and you listen to music that's been filtered through this machine. And so I've actually listened to it along with my son just to see what it was like, and it's kind of irritating, to be honest. But if they've been able to get a real, because you usually try and do auditory testing before and then after. If they've been able to do one before, then they know what areas to work on. But if not, they usually can tell from the type of child that you have, from what the way your child reacts to certain noises. Like my son hates high pitches, but you know, things like vacuum cleaners just don't bother him. Other kids, it's the complete opposite. So the person who's doing the therapy will be modulating the music based on that. And so then afterwards, your child should be able to process more easily auditory sound. And it's funny because we have done it twice with my son, and once was when he was 4 or 5.
Okay.
I think he was close to 5. And that was the first time he ever started reacting to noise, because before he just ignored everything because I guess it was too painful. But once he had the auditory integration training, like if he heard me open the oven door or the refrigerator door and he was hungry, he would come running into the kitchen. That was the first time when I said his name, he would look at me. He never did that before. And now this past time, we just did it over Christmas, and my son actually typed out on the keyboard afterwards, because he was sitting down watching TV, which he usually only watches the same things over and over, and he won't sit down and watch with us. And the first thing that he typed to me when I said something, you know, how's your day going, he said, "Today's the first time that I can actually hear all the different voices on the TV, and it makes sense." And this is why, and I know a few people had asked questions about their kids listening over and over to the same thing, or not wanting to hear certain tapes and only listening to others. A lot of times the reason why they listen to the same things over and over or watch the same videos is, again, they know what's going to happen next, they know what the sounds are, and they're going to recognize the sounds. Whereas right. If you put something new in, it's more work, because they have to try and understand everything and filter things out, so it's not an enjoyable pastime for those who have visual and auditory processing issues. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Well, this is a lot of good information here, and the questions are still pouring in here. We're up to 84 of them so far. I don't know how we're going to get to all of them, but...
I don't think we will. You know what? Some people can also email me at Ask Chantal, for my column if they want. And that's
sure.
Chantal, Chantal, at autismfile.com.
That's right. Say that one more time so that people can write that down.
It's Chantal, Chantal, at Autism File, which is spelled AUTISMFILE.com.
Okay, great. Great. Let's see here. We've got, I got one that just came in, actually, based on something you had talked about. Her name is Lisa from Illinois, and her question was, regarding telling your child ahead of time about what to expect, I found that with my son, if I tell him in advance what to expect or what we plan to do, et cetera, that he frets constantly until the event takes place. I guess she said OCD is taking over. Any ideas?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. It's like you get rid of one problem and then you have another one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what do you do about someone who obsesses? You know, that's a good question, because I've never actually, I've heard of these situations, but I've never helped anybody with that. The thing is that most of the time when there's people who have OCD, for example, there are some kids that OCD on the same things over and over and over, and what we have done in the past is to make it so that the child or the teenager can only do that certain thing or talk about that certain thing, you know, for a certain amount of time that day, so like for half an hour. So I would say basically the same kind of thing. You have a time of the day when you're going over the schedule or over what's happening, and that's when you talk about it, and you don't talk about it at other times. And they do obsess on that, some of them. And one thing that Temple Grandin told me, she said that people called her tape recorder when she was little because she would repeat the same things over and over. The reason why she would ask the same questions over and over is because she liked to listen to the answer.
Right.
Isn't that it? Not the answer in terms of the context of what it was saying, but the sound of the voice.
Right.
The sound of those particular words.
Okay. I have a question here from Sonia, actually, and her question was, my five-year-old chews everything and will put foreign objects in her mouth. What tools can I use to get her to stop?
And does it say how old?
Does not say. No,
okay.
It doesn't say.
When someone's eating, eating things that are non-food items, that's called pica, P-I-C-A. If you want to look it up on the internet, P-I-C-A. And there are various reasons why pica exists. For some people, it is that they're looking for sensations. So another sensory thing, like they need to be chewing on different things. In fact, one of the men that I interviewed for Autism Life Skills said that he did that all the time when he was little. And he was able to replace it as he got older with chewing gum. But he needed to be chewing on something all the time. And that's why he would start getting all these other, putting all these things in his mouth. I have heard, though, that some children who have pica are missing something in their diet or are having other kinds of issues that some biomedical therapies can help with. The first thing I would look at is if it's happening all the time and is if it's only certain materials or objects. But I would definitely consider trying to get them to eat chewing gum if they can.
Right, right. So let's see here. Gosh, so many questions here.
There's so many here. I'm trying to look at the same time you are.
Yeah. Matter of fact, is there one that you want to take up? I think I gave you there was like up to 59, I think, so.
Well, here's one. It has to do with haircuts. My son, it's Terry Atler from Perkasie. My son has sensory issues as he screams whenever he has to get to his haircut. Whenever he has to get his haircut. He doesn't even like to pretend in order that I can desensitize him. Any ideas as to how I can get through this, or at least to the point where he will not scream uncontrollably? Okay, well, first of all, I don't know how old this child is. But secondly, the thing of he doesn't even like to pretend in order that I can desensitize him, your child shouldn't have to think that that's what you're doing. Of course, it all depends on what the situation is. But, for example, if you have some kind of home program, that can be something that's put in the home program. So if you have a certain number of hours in the afternoon that you're doing work with him or that somebody is, that's just part of the program. He sits down, and then you have to do a task analysis of all the different parts of getting a haircut and take data on which parts seem to be the most difficult. Is it a problem just getting him to sit? Is it a problem when he has the scissors? Is there one particular aspect that's a problem? And if it is that, then you start with that. So for the first thing is you maybe want to start on just having him sit. And then you start with the scissors sounds near the ears and see how far you get with that. But the point is if a child knows that you're just pretending, doesn't matter whether they're autistic or not, you're not going to get very far. You just kind of have to make it like, this is what we're doing now. And then you reward him, and you add a couple minutes at a time until they actually sit through it for a while and that they're getting desensitized. But it shouldn't be an option, you know. It's funny because my son has two part-time aides at school, and one of them now that she has good communication with him, with, you know, with the letter board, she's able to get him to spell things out. She constantly is asking him questions about how he's feeling and, you know, or he'll, now that he's figured this out about her, before he goes into science class and he doesn't want to go, he'll say, oh, I feel sad. So then she starts having a discussion with him about feeling sad, and they so that he misses half the class. And the point is, just like I would for my 16-year-old daughter, my daughter can tell me she's sad, and I could say, you know, okay, let's talk about that later, because right now it's time for class. You have to go to class. And then you go back and you talk about it. But when people are using, you know, or taking, when they're getting out of work because we're having all these long-winded discussions with them, it's kind of like with neurotypical kids, there reaches a point where you just say, you know what, right now that's not the time for this. The time is to do this. But, of course, you have the behaviors to deal with, but the behaviors will lessen once they know that you mean business and that that's something they don't have a choice about. Okay, and here's one from Norma Drew from Holland, MI, I guess that's Michigan.
Yeah.
How does sensory integration tie in with autism sensory disorders? Autism spectrum disorders. Boy, I'm getting tired here, huh? So how does... here's what I want to explain to people. To have a diagnosis of autism, there are really only three characteristics that have to be involved, and one of them is problems in communicating. The second one is problems in socialization or social relationships, and the third one is obsessive attachments to objects or topics. Okay, so having a sensory integration problem is not part of a diagnosis of autism, but I have yet to find a person with autism who doesn't have some form of sensory integration problem. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense.
Okay.
And,
now,
here's
what Bob...
Go ahead.
I'm going to say one more and then you can ask me some.
Okay.
Bob from Warren... He has a 17-year-old daughter on the spectrum who has no serious verbal issues but seems to lack a desire to be with peers. She prefers to be alone with a TV or computer and is only comfortable around adults. Can this be a sensory issue? It could be a sensory issue, but it could also, you know, as I explained what some of the adults said, so I would look at the sensory issues. I would also look at, has she been taught social skills? Does she know how to be interacting with other people? If not, or if she's also been bullied or made to feel uncomfortable in how people are interacting with her, like maybe she feels left out or she doesn't feel like she belongs, then that could be why she prefers the company of a TV or a computer. You know, or she's more comfortable around adults, because also adults are pretty... predictable, whereas teenagers, you know, your peers are, or her peers are not predictable. So it could be a sensory issue, but it could also be that, you know, she might be getting teased or she just feels very uncomfortable with the not knowing what to say. And in those kind of things, that's where you could do a lot of social stories and scripting where you practice what's appropriate conversation. What's the appropriate way to interact with peers. But I would look at the sensory things, too.
Okay. Hi, can you talk to us a little bit about, you mentioned cards, for example, a bathroom card and also a take-a-break card, I think.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, how did you arrive at that for your son?
Okay. That's a very good question, and I have to say that a lot of the things that work with my son that I've taught him, well, with the help of the school, it has taken a very long time. My son is the type of student who is very hard to teach anything to. People usually give up, and I'm the one that usually finds the way.
to make it happen.
Sure. Yeah. So I've worked very closely with occupational therapists in figuring things out for my son. But here's what we did with the break card, and I recommend this whenever I speak around the country, because I do a lot of speaking, and I like to give practical information out. I always teach about giving the use of a break card. Now, the reason why you want to have a student be able to ask for a break is as they get older, they're going to be more noncompliant, just like any teenager is more noncompliant. And so you have to give them more choices, and you have to give them control, a little more control of their environment. And this is kind of in preparation for adulthood as well. That's one area. The second area is that if they're going to be needing breaks, you don't want them just getting up and bolting out of their chair. They have to learn that, yeah, okay, if they need a break, they can have it. But it has to be asked for appropriately, and it's not just to get out of work. So here's how I suggest teaching the use of a break card. And you can do this with any ability level. Okay, you can adapt it. So, for example, if you're a teacher or a parent and you're working with your child or student and you notice that, let's say you have an hour, you're supposed to work with him for an hour, and you notice that he always jolts out of his chair and tries to get out of work after 20 minutes. 20 minutes seems to be the cutoff point. That's what you need to do over a few days is analyze the amount of time. So if you're certain that it's 20 minutes, the next thing you're going to do is to you make yourself a break card, and this is really easy. I'm all for low-tech stuff that's easy. You just get an index card and write break on it. If you want to use a stick figure, you can. They have text pictures that have stick figures that show waiting, like someone sitting on a chair with a clock in the background. Well, that's waiting, but you can get a break one where the person is a stick figure and they're breaking like a piece of wood in half. But anyway, so you have this card. So now you're going to carefully watch the clock, and at 18 or 19 minutes, in other words, before this kid is going to just take off from your table, you prompt him to give you the break card, and you say, oh, time for a break, and you let him go. And then you get him back a few minutes later. You know, he can go do whatever he wants for a few minutes. So you do that, and after a few days, the student or the child's going to realize, wow, if I hand over this card, that means I get to get up.
Right.
So then you're going to give him control, and you're just going to leave him the break card, and every time he gives you the break card, you're going to let him go. Okay, so of course what's going to happen? He's going to give you the break card every 5 minutes now, but that's okay, because now, right now you're working on giving him the idea of the break card. So then when you know that he's understood and he's got it down, that it's the break card, and he can have a break when he hands you that, now you're going to take back the time, and you're going to say, okay, we have an hour's worth of work every day, so I'm going to give you, and you know that for 20 minutes he can tolerate sitting, right? Because we already established that as the baseline. So now you say, I'm going to give you 20 minutes. I'm going to give you 3 break cards for the hour, okay? And because that way it could be once every 20 minutes. Whenever you want a break, you hand me a card. So what's going to happen at the beginning is he's going to hand the cards over pretty quickly, but you're going to have to make him stay in that chair and work for an hour. And then he's going to realize after a little bit of time that he needs to not use up all his break cards right away at the beginning. So then he will know that he only has those 3 cards, and he's going to use them whenever he needs them. And so that way it gives him control over it, and he knows that when he needs a break, he is going to get it. So that's a good way to start teaching how to use a break card.
Okay. Good job. Good job. I have, I think that's very helpful for people. They can easily try that, and it's low tech. They can write out the cards just as you mentioned. And it's, at least it's something that parents can try, see if that works for them.
Okay.
Got a bunch more questions here. Let's see here. We're up to 92, by the way. This is,
wow.
So I'm kind of picking and choosing here. I got Julie, who's been pretty persistent. She asked, she's from Canada, and she asked, I have a 9-year-old son diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, ADHD, and SID. He has issues coping with certain sounds, volume, etc., and tends to try to mask that sound by making louder sounds of his own. this is disruptive, especially in the school setting. Any suggestions? I guess that's fairly common, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so can you repeat that one more time? What he's doing is he gets upset when there's certain sounds?
Yes, he says there are certain sounds in the volume specifically. I guess
okay.
As the higher the volume, he tends to speak louder to try to mask that sound by making
okay,
louder sounds than... I'm sorry?
Does it say how old he is?
Oh, yes, he's 9 years old. Is there a problem with my audio? I just want to be sure.
Oh, no, that's okay. It's just me
okay.
Processing.
Okay. Yeah, I guess we are some sensory auditory processing here. Go ahead.
So here, I think, is what's going on. There are noises that are very painful to him. And so it sounds like that he could benefit from some auditory integration training. It's hard to teach someone to change a behavior when the behavior is trying to deal with a pain, and which is what that is for them. If a sound is really too loud for them, that's painful to them. And so Temple Grandin always says you have to differentiate between bad behavior and behavior that's due to sensory issues. Because those kind of behaviors that are due to sensory issues, unless you take care of the sensory issue, the behavior is going to continue. Another thing I suggest that has been successful with some kids is wearing headphones that either are like white noise or that block out some of the sound, or also if people can listen to music very quietly through iPod. Of course, it necessitates being able to tolerate something in your ears or on your head, but often those kinds of things has been very helpful.
Okay. Let's see here. We've got a couple more. Let's see. Sorry, I'm just trying to refresh my screen here. Go ahead.
I've got one here by Christine Nell from Woolrich, and it says, our six-year-old son Max has Asperger's. He has trouble almost every single day around 1 o'clock. It does not matter what he is doing, even if it is a favorable activity, where or who he is with. He becomes extraordinarily emotional, angry, lashes out, complains he is tired, and will not do his schoolwork or anything he is asked. His TSS has been monitoring this, and this has been going on for about a year. We had him tested for low blood sugar. It was negative. And make sure he has adequate snacks throughout the day. We feel so helpless and frustrated that we cannot get him through these rough times. Thank you. Okay. Here's the thing. It sounds like to me, just from this little paragraph, if you've tried all the medical issues, which it sounds like you have, which is good, is that that's his tipping point, is around 1 o'clock. So if he's been holding it together all that time, then it sounds like he's not getting the breaks that he needs from his sensory environment. And so he's having major overwhelm, and it's around 1 o'clock because, I don't know, if he's been at school since 8, maybe after 4 hours, that's too much for him. And I say this because many of the people that I spoke to for my book said that they can't work 40-hour-a-week jobs if it's typical, like, 8 to 9 or 8 to 5 job, because they get sensory overwhelm. And unless they are allowed to have their own breaks when they want them and when they need them, they have a hard time. And we see this pattern in schools. It's usually not 1 o'clock, but this is a 6-year-old. What we usually see happening with teenagers is that they hold it together through the whole day, like the Asperger kids who are waiting to get home, who have been mainstream. They hold it together, and then when they get home, they're so wiped out they don't want to do anything else. Or they have a breakdown in the late afternoon at school, you know, at the end of the day. And it's because they're overwhelmed with all the sensory that they've had to put up with all day. They need a break. Helped some situations here with job coaches who've placed people with Asperger's in jobs, and then they call in sick, you know, after a month or so. And so I talk to the person with Asperger's, and I find out that he can do maybe 2 days in a row of really long hours, but after that he needs a day off. So we figured out what his pattern was, and with the job coach, approached the hotel where he was working and asked him, would they be open to having a two-on, one-day-off schedule? And it worked out, because this guy knew that after 2 days he was totally wiped out and he couldn't handle, he needed a day to just vegetate.
Sure,
and so
sure.
That's why I'm thinking of this for this son, because it sounds like, you know, he's been in there a whole time, a long time. If it's 1 o'clock and he's 6 years old.
Yeah.
So.
Do you want to pick one, or do you want me to pick another?
Okay. How do April G, and it doesn't say where she's from, how do we get this diagnosis? I guess she's talking about sensory integration difficulties. How do we get this diagnosis for our daughter? No one seems to take us seriously. We are still looking for an autism diagnosis, too, but everywhere we go, we are dismissed. Emma is 4 years old. Will occupational therapy help her? Okay. I understand that no one will seems to take her seriously. That seems to be the case unless you have a child who's so out of whack. Like, if somebody has autism and they have sensory integration problem, they automatically take it as being a problem because of the autism. But you can have sensory integration difficulties and not have autism. So occupational therapy, again, by someone with sensory integration training can help this person. The autism diagnosis is a bit difficult. That's a separate thing. Even though if they have sensory integration issues, they may have autism, but it can be separate. So I would focus on trying to find a good occupational therapist with sensory integration. Now, in saying this, I don't know in terms of an IEP whether that's enough, sensory integration needs, if that's enough to get accommodated by the school. It may be something that you have to pay for. I'm not sure that it's a qualifying condition for an IEP. It doesn't sound like it would be unless there's other stuff going on.
Okay. I have a couple here. Let's see. This is an interesting question here. It's probably been touched on before, but maybe she didn't hear the response. But there's a mother here from Orlando who asks, how do you go about finding a good auditory training person or facility? My son is 5 years old with high-functioning mild autism, and lately it seems worse with sounds and holding his ears more than ever before. So it sounds like she's definitely needing some help there. Could you repeat that resource that you had before just one more time? And maybe
I will name this person, even though she's not in
Florida,
but she might be able to help. But while I'm getting it back on my screen, it's very good that this mother's asking questions, because she does need to make sure she has the right professional. So, again, I would look in your area of any for any Autism Society of America chapter or a TACA, that's Talk About Curing Autism, because they now have chapters around the country.
Yeah.
Find out what professionals other people have used and if they're happy with them. And that's how you choose the right professional. Don't listen to just one parent, and try to find parents whose opinion you trust and also who may have a child with a similar type of situation. But just by talking to people, you eventually fall on the right person who can give you information that is logical. Look, I feel terrible about this, but I put off having vision therapy for my son for many years. I've been wanting to do it for about 4 or 5 years, and it's mostly been because of the fear of not getting the right professional. And I have asked around, and I got the names of a couple of people, but those people did not instill in me a feeling of being the right people that would be able to help my son. And what happens is now I have this really great occupational therapist working with my son, who used to work with my son a long time ago, but then you know, because of school district issues, he was no longer there. But now the school district asked him back because they don't have anybody else for my son, and he's great. And he wrote to me and said, you know, have you thought about vision therapy? I know a really good person. And so since I really trusted this professional, I followed his advice. And, of course, I checked up on the practitioner, but I've never met someone as good with my son who doesn't have a specialty with autism. You know, he's a vision therapist, and he does treat children and teens with autism, but he also treats a lot of other people as well. Mm-hmm. So Terry Silverman is at terrysxpc.com, and how that's spelled is T as in Teresa, E-R-R-I-E-S, at E-X-E-C-P-C.com. That's T-E-R-R-I-E-S at E-X-E-C-P-C.com. People might also want to look on the Autism Research Institute website. I'm not sure if they list auditory integration therapists, but that would be a good place to look as well.
Okay. All right. Did you want to take one?
Yeah, I'm going to look list? Here. Okay, my son is in therapy. I think this is from Laureen in Garcho, Grand Rapids, but I'm not sure because it looks like there's three questions there. And her, and that's the name over the top. But I'm taking the third question, which says, my son is in therapy for social purposes. For some reason, it has not helped him. My son is in the 10th grade, and he is having a hard time socializing with other kids. In fact, he is kind of rude to them and not sure what to do. What other types of integration can there be to help him cope with others in school? Okay, well, it'd be interesting to find out what kind of therapy he's in for social purposes, because if it's not helping, then it's not the right kind of social therapy for him, or maybe they have not worked on generalizing, because here's another thing that's very important is teaching generalization skills. So just because a child or a teen understands something and can act it through in one environment doesn't mean it's immediately going to transfer over to another environment, which again has all the other sensory components attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
I would look at different kinds of social therapy. Also, she says, he has a hard time socializing with other kids. In fact, he is kind of rude to them. I don't know her son, but I get this a lot from parents and have read that, and I've seen it myself, that some people with Asperger's, because they have a different way of speaking, sometimes their voice can be a little monotonous, and also they don't understand all the metaphors, and they don't understand the hidden meanings behind things, so that they say things at, and they take them at face value, and to other people it may appear rude, but it's not necessarily that he is rude. It's just, again, it sounds like he needs a lot more social help. Some of the things that can help is not just role-playing and therapy, but what kinds of things are they teaching him? Are they people teaching him about the hidden curriculum? And there's a book out there called Hidden Curriculum. And what this is it teaches things that we neurotypicals take for granted, but that someone with Asperger's or high-functioning autism would not. We have to teach them.
Right.
For example, here's an example. If my daughter's picking her nose, I would say, Rebecca, don't pick your nose. And she, being neurotypical, would think, oh, that means I don't pick my nose in public without a Kleenex. And so she could still go in her room and pick her nose for all I care, or in the bathroom. But when I say don't pick your nose, that just means don't pick your nose in public. Well, if I said don't pick your nose to my to a son that I had who had Asperger's, he might think, oh, my God, that means never, ever, ever pick my nose. So what do I do when I have a problem in that area? You know,
right.
You have to be very clear in teaching these children that there's different meanings to expressions, you know, that not everything is literal. So that's one thing you want to make sure they're learning in social situations. And also, there's books out there that teach about the different metaphors. I think there's one called the Asperger's Dictionary of Everyday Expressions. An Asperger's Dictionary of Everyday Expressions. So it explains about those things.
Yeah, they can perhaps purchase that on Amazon.
Online.
And speaking of which, on your book, could you talk a little bit about your book, your latest book that sort of talks about life skills?
Okay, so I've been talking about the short title, so I'll tell you the long title. It's called Autism Life Skills. From communication and safety to self-esteem and more, 10 essential abilities every child needs and deserves to learn. So every chapter, there's 10 chapters. One's on making sense of the world. One's on communication, safety, self-esteem, pursuing interests, self-regulation, independence, social relationships, self-advocacy, and earning a living. And all these things are things that people should be starting to think about when their kids are little, and there's practical tips in there based on what the adults told me on how you can instill these abilities in your child. But basically, you could start at any age, but it's always better to start sooner than later.
Very good.
Okay.
And now, let me see here. Now, in this book, you can purchase it directly off your website.
People can go to my website, and it'll link to Amazon.
Oh, great.
I'm published with, or they can go to the Penguin website, but Amazon, any major bookstore has my book anyway.
Okay.
Should have all three of my books. And the other thing, I want to encourage people to go to my website because I do have a lot of information on there. When I know everyone's got a lot of free time to read, but the other thing I have, if older parents are interested, is you can get as a download for free from my website a self-employment guide for developmentally disabled individuals that I wrote. It's like a workbook for people like my son who want to have their own business. And the reason why a lot of people are going this route now, and I've worked on a couple of grants here in the San Diego area, that's how I wrote this workbook. It wasn't based just on my son. And what it is that so many of our guys don't have work when they get out of school, but yet they may have a special interest, or they can provide a service that they could earn money from. So it's really about how do you look at what people are interested in and how do you earn money from that, either through a special interest or through a service they can provide. So if people who are interested may want to download that from my website. But obviously, if you have a three-year-old...
What's your website so people can go there?
It's just my name. If you Google my name, you'll get my website. So the website is www.chantal, and then all one word, Cecile Kira, SICILE-KIRA.com. So it's ChantalCecileKira.com.
Okay, what I'll do is at the end of the call, I'll send it out tonight. I'll send out an email with your link to your webpage so that people can actually go to your site and then they can download, I think you said a free excerpt or something from the book or a free excerpt or another.
The whole book is free. The workbook is free. And I just have a lot of information on my website.
Very good. So I'll send that out when we're done. That way people will actually have a record. And then there was another one, too. There was another site, I believe, which you quoted, which was
Autism
Files.
Autism Files.
I'll send that out to people after the call, and that way you don't have to, in case you didn't write it down, we can make sure you get that. You can get access to those online resources from Chantal. Let's see here. Someone here asked what your website address was. Hold on. We'll actually get it to you in the next email, which I'll send to you. Let's see here.
Hey, here's one from Rebecca Bell from New Tripoli in Pennsylvania. My 4-year-old daughter diagnosed... What?
I know that one. Go ahead. Continue.
Okay. Diagnosed with PTD, NOS, and sensory integration disorder, has an issue wearing winter coats. Move to Florida. That's my answer. No, just kidding. Okay. Why do you think I live in California? I don't have to deal with half this stuff anymore. No rain, no washes.
Right.
Okay. She will take off hats and gloves and refuse to keep the coat on. It has been very cold and windy here the past 2 days, and we cannot get her to put on or keep on a coat. I've even given her choices of several styles, one even pink with Dora. She will wear some sweatshirts and one very lightweight windbreaker occasionally. I've resorted to putting her older brother's larger sweatshirts on her over her own. This issue has been ongoing for the past few winters. She also refuses to wear jeans or any other pants that don't stretch. Is there any tips I can try with her that you recommend? She did have an issue getting dressed in the past, screaming fists and wrestling matches, but we have been able to work through that. She also has some postural and reflex issues. Thank you so much. These conferences are amazing. Thank you so much for doing them. There you go, Ernest. That's last things for you. Thank you. Okay.
Oh, yes. Well, people, definitely answer her question. That when just so people know,
yeah, this,
more good things you say about us, your questions will
right.
be answered.
So this is a perfect example of someone who has sensory integration disorder to touch. Okay? And her mother's really smart here because her mother, has kind of figured that out. And she talked about how she did have an issue getting dressed in the past, but she's been able to work through that. That shows how the daughter's been desensitized, so she doesn't scream as much anymore. So what I would say is the mother's on the right track here by putting on different clothes. But this girl is 4, which means that you can do a lot more sensory integration techniques. For example, one thing that they can do when they're 4, which doesn't seem as useful when they're 14, is the brushing. And this is where you have a little, it's like a brush that you hold in your hand, but it's plastic. It's a special kind of brush. And you're going to do it not lightly, but kind of firm pressure on all over the body, like on the arms and on the legs. Again, a sensory integration trained therapist can help with this. And over time, they will be able to tolerate more clothes. I would suggest that up until then, the mother continue with what she's doing in terms of, wearing the sweatshirts and a very light windbreaker. I know it's hard because you want her to be wearing a nice heavy coat, but until you get her able to tolerate, it's not going to be possible. So think about the brushing. I don't know if this person has an occupational therapist with a sensory integration specialty, but that would be really helpful for this girl.
I've got someone here who asked about weighted vests. How can a weighted vest best work for a child with autism while doing a required 1 hour of homework a day? How is the amount of weight determined? What is the frequency and duration that they can wear it to be effective? And what should you do during each break of that hour? So it's kind of a detailed question here. I guess
right.
The general question is weighted vests. I've heard them being used before. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the reason why and
right.
So.
Okay, so a weighted vest, remember when I talked about the backpack earlier and I said that
right.
A lot of the jeans wear a backpack with stuff in it. Well, a weighted vest is something that's used often to give that deep pressure that they need. It's usually just used inside classrooms because it's not very appropriate to have out in public, although some of them, they have more fashionable and they look better now, some of them. But it's hard for me to answer this question. I would think that this person would need to talk to the person who is prescribing the treatment, to the occupational therapist. I wouldn't want to contradict what they're saying.
Sure.
So I don't know how you determine the amount of the weight. That is, again, probably a therapist question. And what is the frequency and duration they can wear it and it be effective? Again, I think it depends on the child. And what should you do during each break of that hour? I have no idea what the therapist would say. I mean, in my mind, I would think to just keep it on because it's given you that continual pressure that you need. But, again, I would say check with the therapist who's helping you out.
I have here's a quick question from someone. They were asking, where can parents actually implement sensory integration training themselves? Is there a place where they can take a class on how to do that or exercise that they can do on their own?
That's a good question. I don't know if there are classes that you can take, but I do know it should be individualized for the child. And I would say to go for an appointment to a sensory integration therapist. I don't know if somebody would give you an appointment without having the assessment or at least some sort of assessment about your child. But they can teach you. In fact, a lot of these techniques, like when I talk about the brushing and the deep pressure, those are things that have to be done every day. And so the sensory integration therapist is going to say that you need to do this every day, and they're going to have to train somebody up, either the parent or the tutor. So I would say if you could find or afford to have someone show you what to do with your child, then that would be the best thing. Because you don't want to be doing something that's not effective with your child. Like when I talked earlier about using a firm brush, well, if someone had a different type of sensitivity issue, then it would have to be a light touch with the brush. So you want to be careful that you're doing the right thing. And so I would say you have to be a specialist who can look at your child.
Okay.
Here's a question from Cynthia in Pensacola. Is that in Florida?
Yes, it is.
No, I'm just wondering because I'm going to be in Tampa, Florida. And I have no idea where that is in comparison to these other places, but I thought I'd tell everybody. I'm going to be out there.
Yeah, I think Pensacola is on the left coast, the far left coast, sort of closest to Louisiana, I guess, and or Mississippi or Alabama, one of those two.
I'm doing a 6-hour seminar on adolescent issues. So,
okay.
In Tampa, Florida, and it's on November 6th or 7th. I can't remember right now. But if anybody wants information, contact me. But here's one from Cynthia. Will giving a child a trampoline outside only decrease the need to jump on and off the bed, couch, and other furniture? If so, what would be the duration and frequency required to meet that need? Okay, definitely a trampoline would be a wonderful way to decrease the need to jump on and off the bed because they're trying for that input they're getting, and it's so much better to get that off a trampoline. I don't know what the duration or frequency required to meet that need would be. Again, that's an individual thing. But I think that the trampoline is such a great idea because obviously you need to have some kind of safety around the trampoline. But it's such a good way to get people's engines running at the right speed. Oh, and that's something I wanted to bring up when we talk about engines running at the right speed. That's because when you look at from a 1 to a 5 and how your state of body is, 3 is what most people are best at. Like your engines aren't running too low and they're not running too high. So you want to try and keep people around a 3. So you kind of, when they get older and you're trying to teach them self-awareness and self-regulation, you want to have a couple-minute discussion in the morning, like settling into school. What speed are you feeling that your engine's low today, or is it high? Obviously, if you have kids that don't have that much communication, you can at least talk to them about what you feel that they're feeling. So, if you see someone who's very hypotonic and fallen asleep, then his engine's low. And if someone's really hyper, then it's engine's high. And you can talk about those kinds of things so they recognize what they're feeling. They become aware of themselves.
Right. I have a comment from someone here who is from Kansas, Johnny, actually, and she says she's not sure of the weight of the vest, but the blankets are supposed to be 10% of the body weight plus 1 pound. We have made several of the blankets ourselves and lap blankets for the kids in our group, and our lap blankets are about 3 pounds. I also have read the time limit to leave these on is about 20 minutes on their remove and replace it, or replace if still needed, which is a comment one of our listeners in Kansas.
That's really good of her to share that.
Yes, it is.
I did want to mention those weighted blankets and lap blankets, because a lot of kids tend to, even at night, seek that sensory input. So it's a good thing to have. Okay.
You want to take one? Got a few more that have come in.
Okay, how about Sue Denton about toilet training?
Ah, that's a good one.
Hi, my name is Sue. I have a wonderful 9-year-old son with autism. I'm having a real hard time potty training him. My son still wears diapers. My mom and I have tried everything. He does not understand when he has the feeling to go to say potty. Please help if you can. Thank you. Okay, I mean, I hesitate to say anything because it sounds like she's tried everything.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it would be interesting to figure out if this little boy, while he's 9 years old, can feel his body and feel when he has to go.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, does he understand that he's supposed to be using the potty? So that's the first thing. And once he's figured out the using the potty, then it's a matter of getting him to use it. So for somebody like him, you'd have to take him. First thing I would do is look at the diaper situation. How often is he wet? And you're going to have to time it for a while to see how often he's wetting, because then you're going to figure out, does he stay dry for a 15-minute period of time? Does he stay dry for a half an hour? Does he stay dry for an hour? Whatever it is, that's the time that you're going to use to start training him, putting him on a schedule, and take him to the restroom every 15 minutes or every half hour. And then eventually you hope to decrease the prompt so that he will go. But remember when I said that a lot of the adults said that they still have problems feeling their bodies?
Mm-hmm.
You can still use all that information I just said to help them use the bathroom, but they might still always need the prompt from a parent or a tutor or a watch when they get old enough to figure that out. So maybe it's hard for him to say potty. Maybe it would be easier for him to actually go there.
Sure.
But in the beginning, it's really just about taking him at timed intervals. And,
it really
depends on the child, because of my son now, who's 19, nearly 20, we still have toileting issues. And again, they're for a variety of reasons, mostly because he can't feel his body at a certain time. But the thing you have to realize is that it's often for families, it's touch and go with the toileting, so that you could have a period of time where the child's not having any accidents. And then all of a sudden, boom, they start having accidents again. And a lot of it can do with anxiety or changes in programs or changes in what's going on in their life around them. If that's their sensitive area, that's going to be the thing that goes first, is the toileting. But you can't get disheartened, because you can always get them back on track. If you've managed to do it once, you can do it again and again and again.
Right, right. I mean, a lot of people don't really understand sort of the struggle that is. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, a lot of people might not understand what this is all about toilet training.
The struggle with toileting?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never thought I'd be talking about toileting issues when my son was 19. But for some kids, it's not a problem at all. I know some kids on the spectrum. They were out of diapers day and night as fast as could be. But these are usually the kids that are a little bit on the hyper end, and that are physically very active. And so they seem to have a good sense of feeling their bodies. So, you know, and they seem to be in control of their movements more. But for other people, it has to do with being able to feel when you have to go to the bathroom, but also understanding where it is that they have to go. But it's true that if they can't feel their bodies, if they're, then you're not going to be able to train them to use the restroom. So you have to keep an eye on that.
Right. Well, tell me something here. Sorry, I'm trying to get my thoughts together here.
I have one here from Donna in Woodbury. I don't know that I can answer very much of her question, but I think it's important because it shows what all of us have to do when our kids get older, too. What type of financial, medical, and educational help is there for children who are in their late teens and have a much milder form of autism, but are unable to function well socially outside of their own home? Our 18-year-old son has not left our home in 2 years except for doctor visits. He wasn't diagnosed until 4 or 5 years ago. Also, we will be moving to North Carolina. If you have any information or contacts for that area, it would be greatly appreciated. Thank you. Well, I'm going to tackle the last bit first. North Carolina has a lot of good resources, and I strongly suggest that you look up the North Carolina ASA chapter and hook in with families there to find out more specifically. But it is really hard, I know, and I think it depends on the state, but it is very hard in California to get help for children after their late teens who have a milder form of autism. And usually it's based on function. So if they're functionally able, they don't have access to certain services. But that's why it's important. You can continually have assessments to help counteract that not getting help when your child clearly needs it. So in terms of financial, I don't know if this person is considered handicapped if he has a milder form of autism. If he's considered disabled, then he should be able to have some kind of financial, like SSI. And often, at least in the state of California, that SSI also kicks in with Medi-Cal.
Right.
So there you have medical coverage and you have a little bit of money coming in. And educational help, that's something you have to get on your own. Now, it's really difficult because I'm finding that I meet around the country where I speak a lot of families where the kids are older, they have Asperger's or high-functioning autism, and what happened is they worked so hard to get their children through school, through the academics, and because there was so much work, they never had time for all the other stuff, like the social skills training, the OT, any kind of therapies that could be really helpful for real-life issues or preparing for adulthood. So what happens is when you graduate from high school, if you have a diploma, it's over in the terms of help that you can get from special education under IDEA, the Individual with Disabilities in Education Act. So what that means is that you're on your own after high school, after you have a high school diploma. So there's community college, and if they're unable to get help and they're unable to function outside of the house, that's really tough. I would really look to see if there's any way that you can get some kind of coaching for your child. And it's pretty scary when I hear that he hasn't left the house in 2 years. Now, I've actually known two or three people, three actually, who never left their house You know, I can't remember the name of that, but there's a psychiatric disorder name for it. It's people that are afraid to leave their house. And these people are not on the spectrum. So it's even harder if you have someone who is on the spectrum, because it's all those areas that they need so much more help with. Obviously, he is feeling much more comfortable at home than out in society. So something must have happened that he feels uncomfortable. Or, you know, nothing could have happened, in the sense of maybe he just had a terrible time in school, in terms of that he was missing friends so much that he felt lonely, and he just feels more comfortable at home. But I would really get concerned about who is following that child or that teenager in terms of medical care and psychology. There should be some kind of job coaching available, and maybe that would help with some of those other areas, like educational. But I wonder if he isn't leaving the house, he can't go to community college or vocational school, but is he able to learn things from the computer? Because there's things that he could learn via online classes that might help him and might provide a connection to the outside world.
Okay. I've got a couple questions here, and one of them actually is one from Pam. She's from Dartmouth, Massachusetts, and her question is, can a high school, such as a vocational high school or agricultural high school, deny admission to a student because a student has a demanding IEP? My son has Asperger's and requires a one-to-one aid for writing notes, and I was warned that the schools could refuse admissions because of that. Not that they will admit that it is a reason, but he's a straight-A student with no history of behavior problems.
Okay, well, I'm not sure about what school district this person is in, but technically speaking, if you move from one district to another district, that district has to honor your IEP. And also it depends on where those schools are located. So, for example, in our area, we live in the San Diego Unified High School District. If my son wants to go to any of the schools that are in this high school district, he is eligible. But the thing is, he would be eligible for the ones that's closest to his home if it's not for a specific program. So, for example, his school is Torrey Pines or Carmel Canyon Academy. So he is at Torrey Pines. But if he were someone who is not mainstreamed or integrated, he might have to go to a school that has a specialized program for him, and that might not be the neighboring school. We're talking about a student, though, that is a straight-A student who needs some accommodations. The thing is, I don't know from what this person is writing, are those schools within his school boundaries? You know, within his right to go to those schools. If it's his right to go to those schools in terms of his address, because a lot of it has to do with your address, and if you're living in the correct school district, then there's no way that they cannot honor his IEP. But again, you have to know about whether those schools are located actually within the same area that he's allowed to go to, geographically speaking.
Sure.
But I know sometimes that happens in school districts. They're going to try to get out of something, or a school's going to try to not have your child because of certain things. But, you know, you just kind of have to get through that. And I would definitely check, though, with the protection and advocacy in your state to find out more. And also you can find out more about that particular school district in that way, too. Every state has a protection and advocacy office. It may not be called protection and advocacy, but you can start looking with those two words first. And what that does is give you free information about anything having to do with disability rights, or educational rights, and so they could answer that question.
Okay. I have another quick question here. It's a little off topic, but it sounds like she really wants to know. She's very impressed with you, and she wants to know if you have any seminars scheduled in the St. Louis, Missouri area this year.
You know what? I was in St. Louis 2 years ago, but the thing is, you know what? If I would suggest people do, because I keep getting asked lately about speaking in different places, and there is an organization that actually organizes seminars. So they have two people back-to-back, 1 6 hours one day, 1 6 hours the next day. And, in fact, that's how I'm going to Tampa, is that somebody heard me when they sent me to Orlando. And so a few people from Tampa wrote to this or wrote to me and said, you know, are you coming in this area? Could you help organize something? And I don't have the time to do that. But what I did is I handed the information over to this organization because they're very good. They're very respectful of the audience, because I've spoken at places where, you know, usually the parent organizations are great and school districts are great, but I've had other companies like this send me places, and they don't care about the comfort of the audience, and they're not very good about the person they bring in. You can tell they're just doing it for money. But this organization, they're the grandparents of children with autism. And so that's why they do this, to provide the best training for parents and for school districts. They provide also the educational units. So I'm going to tell you the name of their company, which I can't remember off the top. I think it's Spectrum Training Systems.
Okay. I think I've heard of them. I may be getting them confused with someone else. But we can,
you know what?
I can
I'm
put that in,
it up right now while we're
email.
Talking.
Okay. And I've got another question here. We've got about 8 minutes left, so this is I might be the last one. It's from Jenny from Elk Grove, California. Her question is, my 8-year-old son has just been diagnosed with Asperger's. We have had no problems with bathroom issues except for him sitting as opposed to standing when using restrooms. Is this common? Should we accept this or work towards standing? Thanks.
Okay, so he's sitting. Do we know how old he is?
8 years old.
8 years old. Okay, well, to be honest, I don't think it's that much of a problem because even in, because I'm trying to think of the future as well as presently, but maybe it doesn't really matter because when he goes out in public and as he gets older, when he goes to use the bathroom in public, there's always stalls with doors that close, and in fact, that's probably a nicer thing for them to learn to use than standing up at a urinal.
Sure.
I don't think it's a real problem. I think if this child feels comfortable doing that, that's fine. In fact, I would feel more comfortable if I knew my son was going into the restroom using a stall instead of a urinal.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never heard of that being an issue for anyone. In fact, I know guys who are not on the spectrum who never like using urinals and who always use the stalls. But maybe you have comments on that, Ernest.
I don't. None whatsoever.
I can hear you flushing on the other end of the phone there.
I have this another question here. It's a little off topic, but I figure we should cover it. Her name is Elisa, and she's a police fire dispatcher for a police department, and she feels that the police need better education on children with these issues, high-functional autism. They are trained to be 90% on the defensive. Are any ideas as to training for police to be more understanding to approaching children and adults with special needs? Thanks.
Is absolutely correct in that this is an area of need, and it's an area of need not just for recognizing children with autism and adults with Asperger's in terms of potential suspects for something, but also for victims, because I've been in the system from the end of someone I know closely being a victim and even as a victim not getting the full rights that a neurotypical child would have because of the fact that they have the autism. So what I suggest we did on a statewide level is we managed to get it written in so that the police are supposed to have more training, but again, you know, who knows when that's going to happen with the way the financial situation is in the state. But there are people that go around and do training. Dennis DeBolt is a very good resource. That's Dennis, and DeBolt is D-E-B-B-A-U-L-T. He is someone who goes around and does training. He used to be a security officer himself. I'm not sure if he was in the police, but the police love him, so they do training. But he also makes videos that he sends around, training programs. So I would contact someone like that. And if you're already in the organization, you know, if you're either in the police or in the firemen, it's easier to get it in as a parent of a child with autism. So, for example, here in San Diego, we have, as a member of our ASA chapter, a fireman who has a child with autism, and he's the one who had convinced the firemen and the police department here to bring in Dennis DeBolt to do training. And so there is a lot more training available. It's just, as this person knows from working, that firemen and policemen and all these kinds of people who are there to protect us and help us, they're overworked and overbooked. So it really means that someone who has a passion for it, like a parent who's in the forces, to bring in the training.
Okay.
Is that helpful?
Yes, I think it was. I know I've seen things written that have cards for kids where, you know, if a police officer sees this card, then it kind of instructs them as to what to do and not to do, assuming that they can get the card from the kid.
I think if you go to the National Autism Society of America website, I think you can get those from them.
Right. You can print them off on your computer or something, or even, I think you can actually send for them.
Right. And I wanted to name the name of that company, Spectrum Training Systems.
Spectrum Training Systems, okay.
Yeah. So you can always write to them and ask if they're going to have me in St. Louis or that you would like to.
Okay.
Or wherever anybody lives that they would like to see me.
Well, we're coming up on about 3 minutes here. I'm sorry?
Did you have one more question you want me to try and answer?
Let's see here.
Or are you wrapping it up?
I'm going to extend it for about a few more minutes, and I'll say, her question is Terry from Percocet. Her question is, my son has sensory issues as he screams whenever he has to get his hair cut. He doesn't even like to pretend in order that I can desensitize him. Any ideas?
No, I already answered that one.
Oh, you did? Okay. You already have that.
Yep.
All right. Okay. Maybe you can pick one that we haven't gotten here. There's just so many here.
Okay.
I already asked one about, is there training for a parent on sensory integration therapy? Are there... So, let's see.
Here's one from Kiri J. Vocal in Knoxville. My son is 3 years old, and recently he has got where he doesn't like to hear or see his videos or songs for kids, but he does in his class at school. He is in an early intervention program. He gets very upset if I try to play his music or videos. He scratches me on my arms. What should I do? This could be a couple of things. It's kind of interesting because normally they like to hear the same thing over, but maybe he is fed up with them and he wants something new. Or I'm not quite clear here if the son is still tolerating the same videos or songs at school, it's just that he doesn't want them at home. Or is it that it's certain videos or songs for kids that he doesn't like at all anymore? Maybe it's bothering him a certain pitch, but that's no reason for scratching. scratching someone on their arms. I suggest that these music or videos, those are things that should be optional for someone, and so it's not worth forcing someone to listen to that if it's going to make them scratch you. But obviously the scratching is trying to communicate something. There's something he doesn't like about that. So I would just try and find other tapes and videos. And maybe he's just all of a sudden sick of them.
That could be. I've got one last question. I'll take this one because I think it's pretty topical here. And that is, you, hopefully we didn't answer this one, but I was answering that. And her question is, I'm new to this. What exactly is involved in a sensory integration evaluation? What happens after the results from the evaluation are received?
Okay, good question. So in a sensory integration evaluation, the occupational therapist who is trained would be observing your student or child, and they would normally observe them in a variety of environments. So visit them at school, visit them at home, possibly. And if they have a clinic, if they're clinic-based, they probably would also see them at their office. But they would also have to go and see them at least in one other environment to see how the person reacts to what's around them. And they just, I can't say exactly what kind of things they do, but they look and see how their fine motor skills are, their gross motor skills, and their reaction to noises and lights by observing their behaviors. And if obviously if they're verbal, they'll ask them questions. And then they'll also interview. They usually, if they do a very thorough one, they'll ask the teacher and they'll ask the parents to respond to questions in a, on a form. So you can answer what you see your child acting in certain situations. Because that gives a lot of information, because some they may act one way in one environment and one way in another because of environmental issues. Once an assessment is written up, the assessment should say what areas the child is having challenges in, and then it should come up with the conclusion of what can be done to help. So in terms of how many hours of therapy, or does the person need sensory integration, does the person need auditory integration training, whatever kinds of things that this person thinks would be good for the child, and recommend them. And then there should be an IEP meeting to go over the assessment, and then a plan put together of what's going to be provided by the school district for this assessment.
Okay. Well, I think that ends the call tonight. But before everyone goes, first step is I want to thank Chantal once again for giving us this great talk. This has been a wonderful call on sensory integration, as well as just answering generic questions here about autism, which Chantel has handled this call very well for us, and I certainly appreciate it, and we all thank Chantel for taking the time to do this. And then, two, I need you to do something for me. I know you've heard this call for about 2 hours. I really would appreciate your feedback. Oftentimes, you know, we need to get new speakers or we need to convince other people to come in and join us on these calls. We'd love to have you tell us what you liked about the call, what you'd like to see different. Is there any subject that you'd like to cover that we didn't cover tonight that we could put on a future call? And just tell us what you liked about it. We'd love to get your feedback and your testimonial. Is there anything that you heard that it was an aha moment that said, yeah, okay, I'm going to do this. This is the takeaway that I have. Well, the feedback that I want you to give me, you can give to me directly over the phone. And I'll show you exactly how to do that. If you could just take a moment, get a pencil and paper, and write this number down. It is 877-211-0212. Once again, that number is 877-211-0212. 0212. And this number, you dial it, you're going to hear a message and you press 1, and that's going to take you directly to where you can record what I just asked for, which is tell me your name, give me your email address if you can, and then what you thought about the call, what things you liked about it. Was there an aha moment for you? Is there something that you can say that you would say to someone to recommend this to someone else, for example? So just give me your feedback. I'd love to hear your testimony. If there's anything in there you really got out of, you really loved. And once again, that number again is 877-211-0212. That's 877-211-0212. So that's the call tonight that's come to an end. We have one more call here this month, which is going to be on autism and insurance. And we have a woman who is going to be talking to us about how she was responsible for Ryan's law. Her son is named Brian, and she fought the legislator in South Carolina to actually get the insurance companies to cover certain types of treatments in autism. And she's going to tell our story. She's very exciting, and it turns out that Chantel is actually going to be the moderator. So it should be a lively call with the two great people just talking about autism and talking about how they were helpful in getting this this rule passed for her child. So once again, thank you so much, Chantel. Thank you very much again, and to all a good night.
Well, thank you. Good night.
Good night.